There we go. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the beginning of 4 weeks on the history of the Black Church in America. I think this is going to be a fascinating series. I really can't wait. And the good news in all this is that we have a good friend, the Reverend Dr. Jack Opperley, who really, I think it's maybe an understatement to say that he's been a favorite of the Westminster Seminars for many years. He brings a broad knowledge of Christianity and history to the subject, and I won't drone on. I'll just say we are all really looking forward to this and very grateful for your coming to us from the heartland of Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Ted. I just want to say I'm very pleased and happy to be able to do this. We moved to Oley, Pennsylvania in August, and I just assumed that there would be no way to honor my commitment with your seminar group, but I'm so delighted to be able to do it. And I'll do my best to keep us moving in a good direction. And beyond that, maybe at the conclusion, have a couple of questions if someone is interested in doing so. Ted has asked me to open the day with just a moment of reflection. Could we pray? Eternal God, we give you thanks for the meaning of the church, for the wonder of relationships, for the joy of learning, and above all, for your care, which does support and sustain us. May this day honor you, bring to those who have gathered a sense of purpose and joy through Christ our Lord. Amen. My interest in the Black Church began several years ago, and it was in some measure spurred on by an experience I had back in graduate school. There was a wonderful guy there. His name was Bill Gray. Some of you may recognize that name if you're from the Philadelphia area, because there's a subway station named after Bill. He represented your congressional district for a number of years in the Congress. He also was the director of the Negro Education Emergency Drive. Just a very significant person. And back there in Drew University, one day Bill and I were having a conversation and he was noticeably troubled. And then he shared with me this bit of information. He said, "You know, Jack, I went down to get my hair cut today." Bill came from a family in which his father was an African-American, his mother was Caucasian. And Bill's hair was very much Caucasian. He went to a barbershop. He did have a black face. And as a result of that, the barber, using ugly terms, suggested that what he needed to do was go to the N barbershop. Bill then began to share with me his personal history. And he said, "You know, Jack, when my grandfather entered a bank to secure a loan to buy some property, he was told that he needed to get clean. When my father interviewed for jobs, he was clean, well-dressed, but he was told, 'N, you need more education.'" And then Bill paused for a moment and he said, "Here I am, clean and educated, and I still can't get my hair cut." I share with you that bit of history because I think it depicts for us the dilemma of African-Americans in the history of our culture. And beyond that, it speaks to why it is that the Black Church has become such a formative reality in that same culture. I am indebted today to two books, Henry Gates' book, The Faith We Sing, and also to Laron Bennett, and the book that he wrote several years ago, which is entitled Before the Mayflower. And in both of those works, the authors make the case that before we can possibly begin to understand the nature of the Black Church, its role in the contemporary society, we do have to understand from where it came. And beyond that, we have to understand the very nature of the slave trade during the 16th and 17th century. And so today I begin by talking how it was that African Americans came to the shores of the New World, ultimately to be called the United States of America. Unlike hunters unlike farmers, unlike explorers, unlike developers, African Americans came to these shores as slaves. They did not choose to come. They were sold and bought and treated as property. Many of us have been taught that the beginning of the slave trade in our country began in 1619 when a British privateer ship entitled the White Lion sailed up the Jamestown River and lowered their anchor. And there were, this comes out of a log, there were 20 odd Negroes that were on that ship as slaves. They were subsequently sold to the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And also some of them were sold to a very prominent businessman. It is important to understand how those 20 odd Negroes got to the shores of Jamestown. Number one, we have to understand that they were rounded up on the western coast of Africa in the area that today we call Angola, and then again, Congo. And then they were marched usually from their tribal homes to the coast. And there they were put into what amounted to concentration camps. And there was no regard for their humanity. There was no sense of being aware of the traditions out of which they came or the values that they held. They were simply treated as property. What is interesting to me is that those 20 persons who arrived at that point in our history, 1619, actually, they had been stolen by their English captors from a Spanish ship, the Batista, as it was trying to take slaves back to Spain. I raise that simply to suggest to you that perhaps the slave trade was inhabited by the kinds of people who had little or no regard for law, and certainly had little or no regard for the commodity they were capturing. I need to talk a little bit about what happened to a slave once they had been processed through these concentration camps. They were loaded on ships. They were usually chained to levels of what we would call tables, shelves. And that meant that a slave living, being channeled to the very bottom realm, suffered all kinds of indignities concerning the health and safety of life from all of the people who were chained above them. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine the terrible sense of nothingness? Henry Gates talks a lot about, as those African Americans captured, held in concentration camps, and finally put on ships in a spoon kind of fashion, many of them never saw the light of day for months. They had no sense of the directions in which they were sailing. They had no awareness of how to calculate time. They lost their orientation toward life. It is called the middle passage, the moment from which many slaves did not survive. For on the hold of those ships, chained to those tables, the question became, could you survive? When they arrived in Jamestown, they were sold, as I've indicated. We're not quite sure what happened to those 20 people, because at that point in time, not too many records were kept concerning slaves. However, what's important for our understanding this morning is this. 1619, Jamestown, 20 odd Negroes, really was not the first expression of slavery in the New World. As early as 1520, there are records of slavery being practiced in places such as the Dutch New York, or then again, Swedish Delaware, or then again, Spanish Florida and Louisiana. Here's an interesting bit of information. Christopher Columbus, one of his most important functions was to gather up slaves and bring them back to Spain, where they were indentured for life. Most scholars today understand that slavery in the New World has been around for a very long time. It is something that began somewhere in the 16th century and continued up through the 18th century. It was a black moment in the history of the world. Once in the Jamestown community, the British government, and more critically, the British citizens who were inhabiting and developing the New World, began to realize that slavery was the best option they had for a cheap, accessible workforce. And so they set about the task of institutionalizing slavery. How did they do that? Perhaps one of the most important things was something called the Virginia Slave Code. It was passed in 1705 in the House of Burgesses in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And may I share with you this morning some of the dimensions of that code. Number one, barbaric, brutal treatment of African-American slaves was actually authorized as being legal by this code system. Think about that. In 1705, the Virginia Slave Code said, hey, it's all right to treat a slave as if they were not a person. Number two, the Virginia Slave Code also said that no slave could own a weapon of any kind, and that included a firearm, a knife, a pick handle, anything that was perceived to be a potential weapon was made illegal. Number three, in the slave code, African Americans were perceived as and treated as property. In fact, in some expressions of the code, animals were really perceived in a much higher level than the slave himself. Why? Because animals could not be replaced easily. As the slave market was developing, it was not a problem. Number four, the slave code said that indeed, a slave needed to accommodate and adjust to their new environment. And one of the ways in which they did that was to insist upon the fact that slaves would not speak their own native tongues, even to each other, under the penalty of losing their tongue. They must learn the language of the master. It reminds me of the Babylonian captivity of the nation of Israel. You will remember that as the Babylonians were threatened by the Israelis, and as they were brought back to Babylonia in captive, one of the things that the Babylonians insisted upon was indeed speaking their language. Once the slave code was institutionalized, it allowed for the implementation of slavery to begin. And that is kind of a curious thing because the initial exposure that an African American had to the slave system wasn't all that bad. For example, they were encouraged to take walks in the woods. Why? I can't answer. Number two, they were treated with some degree of kindness. Number three, they were taught the intricacies of raising cotton and tobacco. But once those kinds of preliminaries were finished, the reality began to be expressed. Number one, slaves were not permitted to gather in groups larger than five individuals. Think about that. Five individuals was the max of a slave gathering. And always, always, there was present the overseer equipped with firearms and, of course, a whip. They were also told how to deal with the crop. And that meant that if you failed in caring for and developing the crop, you were subject to serious penalty. Three, there was no sense of family. Marriage between and among slaves was not permitted. It was illegal for a slave to marry. And therefore the family structure, which ironically mattered so much to the African Americans, was obliterated. Finally, we need to see that their religion was taken from them. Contrary to popular belief that somehow teaches us that the African Americans came from Africa as a kind of a wild animal needing to be tamed, that is not true. Studies have indicated that along the western coast of Africa, from where many of these slaves came, there was a high degree of religious orientation. Now, you're right. It was not the white European understanding of religion. For example, African religion tended to worship their ancestors. And when we say worship, what we're really talking about is remembering the heritage out of which they had come. Their religion was very mindful of and sensitive to the fact that we are not accidents, but rather we come from something or someone. Number two, they also had a panoply of gods. They had a god for the harvest, a god for the planting, a god for rain, a god for sun. Admittedly, it was not the monotheistic concepts of God as Christianity would develop. However, particularly Henry Gates talks about the fact that these Africans really did believe in the gods that they named. Three, they also brought with them a kind of openness. Psychological studies have suggested that the religion that was practiced along the western coast of Africa was not something that had to do with an either-or approach to life. It much more had to do with the both-and approach to life. They were much more compatible in their differences. They accepted one another. While tribal war did exist, it never existed over the issue of religion. Those of us who come from that white European background cannot make that claim. Also, what most people don't understand about the African American as they came as slaves to the New World was many of them were Muslims. Muslims were very strong in Africa. They had a real sense of identity with the Muslim tradition. They understood the value of Allah. They also understood the value of Muhammad, the great prophet. And therefore, their religion really was an important component of their life. That was not good enough for the white slave owners. White slave owners believed that, in fact, what needed to happen was that a slave needed to become a Christian. Interestingly enough, one of the very first experiences that slaves often have after arriving at a plantation is to be taken by their master to church, where they are baptized, where they begin to be taught the traditions of Christianity. And when we talk about what they were taught, that becomes very, very curious. It was what became known as slave Christianity. Slave Christianity was put together primarily by the Anglican Church of that era. And the Anglican Church of that era was in some degree of conflict concerning slaves. For example, British law said that it was illegal for any man to enslave another man. However, that was in conflict with the fact that British law also said that Christianity was exclusively the religion of white people. And of course, in addition to all of that, the Anglican Church had actually included in one of its creedal statements that God, think about this, God had ordained the plight and the position of Africans obviously to be under the control and domination of their white counterparts. The Christianity that emerged, known as slavery Christianity or Christian slavery, pretty much drew God into the equation by suggesting that, number one, God was the creator of the universe. Number two, God had created some to be free and some to be not free. Those who were free were freed on the basis of being white. Those who were enslaved were enslaved on the basis of being black. And thus we see the beginnings of what in America today we sometimes call racism. The Bible in this context became an interesting tool. The white slave owners did the Bible teaching themselves. And as a result, they centered on texts that come from the New Testament, which of course, some of which say, remember slave, be obedient to your masters. They also utilized texts that suggested that life can be hard, but if we play by the rules and are obedient in our living, we will be rewarded in the world yet to come. The Christian slave religion had but one objective: to totally and completely disorient Africans from their heritage and to teach them that their role, their God-ordained role in the world, was to be a slave, and that they must always honor, accept, and be faithful to that role assigned to them. What the white slave owners did not understand was that the African tradition out of which these people had come was very strong. And so while it was that the slaves necessarily had to accept what it was they were taught, they did not have to believe it. And religion for the slaves became an interesting hybrid. Yes, there was the white Anglican traditions of God ordaining life for slaves, of God being in charge, and of, yes, doing your job well and being rewarded in the life to come. No question about that. However, alongside of that, there was the African influence. There was about that influence a kind of, I call it, spiritual joy. They had to find it somewhere, and they found it in their faith. There was also a sense of dignity. Many of the slaves that were brought to the shores of America were people who were considered to be leaders in their tribes. They were princes. And they were people who carried themselves and who conducted life with enormous dignity. That kind of blended into the religion of the day. Blacks were left with the probability of coming up with a religion that would do a number of things. Number one, help them to understand their own blackness. Number two, to help them understand their white slave owners. And number three, provide for them and the generations yet to be a sense of the future. As that invisible church, which is the theme we're developing today, as that invisible church began to take shape, there are two institutions that grow up out of that experience that are still a part of the Black church today. Here is the first one. It is called the Negro Spiritual. That's a technical term. It describes a venue of music that is unique to the Black community. The Negro Spiritual really began as what is known as a shout song. And what that means is it had about it a sense of life, a sense of experience, a sense of joy, a sense of great celebration. The shout song, in terms of the Negro Spiritual, gave the slave a little bit of hope, a little bit of comfort, an opportunity for some joy. The Negro Spiritual also addresses the theme of death. That is understandable because death for the slave was a constant companion. Slaves were killed for all kinds of reasons, speaking their own tongue, not doing the job the overseer felt they should do. And of course, if they ever dared to rebel. So that death for them was a constancy that was a part of their experience. And the death of which they were so familiar was usually an ugly, violent death. It wasn't simply the reality of death which ends life in a way that we might call natural. Death for them was a frightening experience. And as a result of that, the Negro spiritual developed the themes associated with death, primarily that on the other side, there were streets of gold. On the other side, there was no crying or pain anymore. On the other side, they would be reunited with spouse, with child, with parent, with colleague. The Negro spiritual, a technical term, becomes the heartbeat of the Black church. And that continues in today's world. I don't know if any of you had the opportunity to witness Colin Powell's funeral service this past week. But if you did, you will remember that at one point, a gospel singer stepped to the pulpit and sang that great hymn, "How Great Thou Art." It was a high moment in that service because it celebrated the reality of death, to be sure. But it also celebrated that we do not die in vain. It also celebrated that faith brings us through the death of life. And more critically than that, that we die unto a God who is a God of life. Negro spirituals began in the slave quarters of South Carolina, Mississippi, Virginia. And it was one of the ways by which the Black church found its destiny. Second institution, the Black preacher. The Black preacher became a leader in the Black community. The Black preacher was treated with tremendous respect and honor. The Black preacher was perceived as someone who had been called by God. It had nothing to do with intellectualism. It had nothing at all to do with degrees. It had nothing at all to do with power structures. It had to do with the fact that the slaves began to understand that the one who rose among them as the preacher had been called to that role by the reality of God. And as a result of that, the Black preacher became something of a leader, not only in worship, but also in the wider community. For example, the Black preacher mostly was an illiterate person. They did not have much in the way of training or school. However, they had been exposed over the generations, you see, to what we call the oral tradition. They had mastered the biblical images in the context of memory in their mind's eye. And as a result, they would tell the stories of the oral tradition to their constituents. And what were some of the stories they talked about the most? Well, I'm sure you all can answer that question. One story had to do with Moses. How it was that Moses himself became something of a slave. But how it was that God said to Moses, "Go down and set my people free." The Black preacher embodied and taught the wonder of a man like Moses, whose mission was to free the slaves from the hateful treatment of their Egyptian overseers. They also talked an awful lot about the story of Joseph. We all know that story, how he was resented by his brothers, and how it was that they ultimately beat him up and put him in a pit, and how it was that some people came by, and how it was that they rescued him from the pit, and how he became a leader in Egypt, a patriarch of the community. The Black preacher, while he had not been to college and seminary, he understood the oral tradition, and he used it most effectively. A third component, which is kind of, I think, you don't think about this, but I think it's important to talk about. Henry Gates teaches us that it is estimated that between 20 and 25% of the African people who were brought to this shore and enslaved were able to hold on to some kind of an understanding of life that was related to their Muslim faith. Henry Gates if you haven't read his book, you really do need to do that. Let me. This is the book, The Black Church. This is our story. This is our song. And in that book, Gates talks about how the Muslim tradition of suffering through adversity, but always finding ways to resist that adversity, continued to live. He writes in the book that it was no surprise to him that in the 20th century, we see the development of a man whose name was Malcolm X. He says it's no surprise to him that Cassius Clay ultimately said, "I am Muhammad Ali," that those two men represent the lingering reality of the Muslim tradition that refused to be subject indefinitely to difficulties. So we have the Negro spiritual, we have the Black preacher, and then we have this interesting thread of theological understanding called the Muslim tradition that are all woven together into something called the Black Church. I've been pretty hard on Anglicans this morning. And I apologize to any of you who come out of that tradition, but we have to look at our history. And as we look at our history, we also have to give thanks for a man who was an Anglican priest, to be sure, but who was also more than that. His name was Morgan, M-O-R-G-A-N, Morgan Goodwin. He accepted everything that the Anglican Church taught about Blacks and slaves. They were ordained to be slaves. Their slavery was contingent and caused by the color of their skin. Their job was to, in fact, obey the master. He bought into all of that because he had no choice. But Morgan Goodwin, I think, must be celebrated as a man who represented a voice in the wilderness. And this is what the voice said. He said that while it is that indeed a slave may be ordained to that way of life, and while it is that Blackness maybe does connote the reality of slavery and captivity, that does not mean that a slave or a Black person does not have value and should not be thought of as a person, and that being thought of as a person meant that a Black person could be educated. And so amid all of the conflicting realities of the time, Morgan Goodwin actually developed schools where slaves were taught to read, they were taught to write and to cipher and to develop their own sense of value. We must keep in mind that the Presbyterians, as they emerged in the 17th century, were very open to the supporting of slaves and trying to minister to them. Whenever the Methodists came along in their circuit riders, they actively proselyted slaves and gave them a sense of dignity and purpose. Next week, we're going to talk a little bit about Richard Allen, who had been a slave and became a Methodist, and as a result, developed the concept of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. But perhaps beyond the Anglicans, beyond the Presbyterians, and beyond the Methodists, one of the most significant spiritual realities of this time were the Quakers. The Quakers early on opposed slavery. They found it to be a curse of humanity. They sought to raise up those who had been enslaved in slavery and set them free. And Henry Gates makes an interesting observation about Quakers. He writes that the Quaker movement in America had a very difficult time moving forward. As Quakers came to the shores of the New World, oftentimes they were rejected by the Puritans who were in charge. And they were told to go off to Barbados, that there was no room for them in the New World. Quakers, nevertheless, understood something. It was not enough to feel sorry for a slave. It was necessary to change the context in which slavery received validation. Quakers, according to Gates, did a couple of things for the slave community of their day. Number one, they helped slaves to understand their blackness. And that understanding meant that their blackness in no way defined them in terms of being a slave forever. Their blackness could in fact become a source of their dignity, a source of their purpose, the kind of thing that we've heard in the civil rights movement that said, I am black and I am proud. Quakers were responsible for that. Number two, they also were helpful in terms of understanding the white slave owner. And what that means is they understood how you manipulate that slave owner and how it is that you play the game and how it is that you find ways to address it. The Quakers understood the necessity of survival. Number three, the Quakers also allowed for black slaves to have a sense of purpose. What we mean by that is they found purpose in their work in the field. They found purpose in structuring together some sort of community with some kind of cohesiveness. The Quakers were interested in making sure that slaves did not totally and completely lose their sense of identity, which had come out of Africa. The Quaker movement, says Gates, is indeed a grandparent of the Black Church in America. I better watch my time here. Let me just make a few other points and then we'll be on to some questions. Along with the Black preacher and the singer of the gospel, we have to understand that in the slave quarters of the 16th and 17th century, in America, a vision emerged. It was a vision of an invisible community. They were not allowed to have buildings. They were not allowed to have gathering places. But the Black church, as an invisible institution, began in the slave quarter. And what did that Black church ultimately become and do? Number one, it ultimately produced Black denominations, primarily in the Methodist and Baptist traditions. That is to say, places where they had buildings, where they had structure, and where they had organization. Number two, it also developed something called the Underground Railroad. You all remember that. It had to do with that magnificent system that ran up and down the East Coast, allowing for slaves to escape the horrific life that they lived and making their way perhaps into a northern city or even more importantly, into Canada. Number three, it also allowed for them to realize that there was something about a Black culture that was unique and worthy of survival. The Black church infused into the Black community a sense of cohesion and purpose that we saw and see in all kinds of ways in the 20th century. And lastly, the Black church, beginning in the slave quarters of the South, really becomes the grandparent of what we in our era in the 20th century have known as the Civil Rights Movement. In the last lecture that I'll be sharing with you, we're going to talk about the new voices that rose up out of the Black church and called for justice and for honor and for dignity. The invisible church was indeed a powerful ingredient in shaping the destiny and the future of the African slave. This is what Henry Gates writes. The Black church in America testifies to two realities. First, the spiritual vitality of Blackness. And secondly, the strength of enslaved, brutalized people to make a difference. James Caan, great theologian at Union Seminary, unfortunately left us in death this past year, would ultimately capitalize on those notions and begin the development of something that we will call Black theology. And what that meant was that Black faith has about it a sense of survival. It has about it a sense of intensity. It is something that will not be easily ignored or destroyed. And secondly, that it can overcome the brutality and the barbaric treatment visited upon people based upon the color of their skin. And so I return to where I began with a friend, Bill Gray. Bill Gray went on to become a congressman. He anticipated running for a Senate seat. However, Bill Gray, this is in the last decades of the 20th century, was unable to move in those directions. The power of the structures of political reality kept him from moving forward. And as he said to me in that memorable conversation, "Here I am, Jack. I'm clean. I'm educated. And I still cannot get my hair cut." That is the cauldron in which the Black church in the slave quarter began. It is the Black church that we will continue to study and see in the weeks before us. I don't know how we do this, but I'm certainly willing to hear from questions. And once the recording stops, I think Ted indicated if and when that happens, we could linger on for as long as you like. So whoever has a question, feel free to answer.